meeting of the Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy Committee will come to order, or as it's becoming commonly known as the Representative Moran Bill Committee. First, Representative Myra, would you move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I've looked at the minutes for February the 26th, February the 27th, and March the 5th, and I move them.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Moran moves her bill 1141 to pass and be referred to Committee on Education Finance. Is that correct?
Is that what you have, Mr. Chair?
That's what we have. Probably correct. okay, Representative Moran, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for having me here and the opportunity to introduce this bill. House File 1141, what it does is make an infants and toddlers who have experienced homelessness eligible for Part C. Research and practice experience has shown the homeless is among the most traumatic experiences a young child can face. In addition to the lack of a stable place to live, they may be living in deep poverty and a family fleeing domestic violence and social isolation with few supports. One study, for instance, found that half of homeless preschoolers have a developmental delay, a major developmental delay, and delay in more than one area: large, gross motor, fine motor, and social development. I would like to share with you that I was a part of a work group called the Invisible Child Work Group, which really focused in on homeless children 0 to 5. And what I found impactful or so important about this work group is that when we look at homeless families and parents, we're usually trying to reconnect families with housing. But in the midst of trying to reconnect families with housing, a lot of times those mothers and fathers are walking around with babies and young children who are so often invisible. And we talk so often about the need to have young children in high quality care, in a stable environment, in a nurturing environment. And many times we have these kids who are these babies who are with their mom day to day looking for housing, but we don't see them. So hopefully this bill would help bring some light to those kids, those children who are invisible at times, and also giving us some of the support they need early in life to ensure that they are developing correctly in a good way. So to explain the bill more, I have Marcy Jeffrey here from the Children's Defense Fund, who will go a little bit more through the bill step by step. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Jeffries, just state your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Jeffries. I'm with the Children's Defense Fund. And we so much thank Representative Moran for bringing this bill to the committee and for you hearing the bill. The bill is fairly short. It has the main part of the bill makes infants and toddlers who are experiencing homelessness eligible for Part C. Part C is also called early intervention and also called Help Me Grow. Those are services that are provided by the school districts. The services that are provided include speech and language therapy, nutrition, physical therapy, and family counseling. The services are intended to help babies and toddlers learn the skills that most children typically develop on their own during the first 3 years of life, including crawling, walking, talking, and playing, eating, and dressing. As part of the Part C services, a family coordinator helps families develop an individualized service plan and identify other potential services. Research has shown Part C to be effective in reducing the need for future special education services. A study done at the University of Minnesota a few years ago found that a third of the infants and toddlers that they tracked through to second grade were no longer in special education. In Minnesota, Part C is funded through a combination of federal funds, state general ed revenue, special ed revenue, and local levy districts. And districts can also bill for third-party reimbursement through Medi-Cal assistance. States can define who is eligible for Part C. Currently in Minnesota, children must be exhibiting a developmental delay or being diagnosed with a condition with a high probability of delay, such as Down syndrome or fetal alcohol syndrome. Some states, however, to prevent developmental disabilities from developing in children who they know are at high risk for developmental delay, also include children who are at risk. This includes children whose parents have a parent with a diagnosed severe mental disorder, or they may require additional risk factors, such as a parent who is younger than 15, a parent who is using alcohol or other substance abuse while pregnant, or a child who is homeless. In Minnesota, the percent of 0 to 3-year-olds who are receiving Part C services is below the national average, and it's also below surrounding states, although the rate has been increasing in the last several years. The bill also adds a representative from agencies who serve families who have experienced homelessness to the regional interagency early intervention committees, which administer and do outreach for Part C. And the bill requires the Department of Education to report annually on the number of children who are homeless who have received Part C, so to determine the effectiveness of both the outreach and the services. I think there are some people who can testify in more detail about the actual issues. And we have a handout as well.
Sharon, are you going to I've got you listed. Are you going to testify? Or okay, come on down. And Janelle Lepa? Oh, get right up there, ready to go. Oh, I was going to. Ms. Henry Blythe, do you just want to state your name and where you're from, and then go ahead?
My name is Sharon Henry Blythe. I work for the Family Housing Fund as the director of the Visible Child Initiative. The impact of homelessness begins well before a child is born. The overwhelming majority of homeless parents are single women, many of whom were homeless themselves as children. Homeless women face obstacles to healthy pregnancies, such as chemical abuse, chronic and acute health problems, and a lack of prenatal care. Trauma and homelessness has a significant impact on a young child's development. Persistent distress, such as being without a stable home, witnessing domestic violence and community violence, lack of reliable and responsive caregiving, poor nutrition, all contribute to a child's unyielding feeling of instability, fear, and anxiety, significantly compromising their early development. Research shows that by third grade, programs for children with antisocial behavior are mostly ineffective. Providing infants and toddlers who have experienced homelessness access to Part C early intervention services can give these babies a fair chance. We can improve developmental outcomes, decrease the likelihood of a need for special ed services, and promote school readiness for very high-risk children. I'll share a little story with you. In 2006, I did a research project with Supportive Housing to get a better understanding of the status of homeless children that are currently living at that time in supportive housing. One of the moms I talked to, as I was talking to her about her 4-year-old at that time, she said, well, he used to bump his head up against the wall all the time, but he doesn't do that so much anymore. This young mom had moved from north side to south side, from suburb to inner city. She had a caregiver, she had a medical provider. No one had noticed that this child, even by 4 years old, was having significant difficulty in his social emotional development. With Part C, this would have been caught much earlier, very early on. The good news is we know what to do. Early intervention is vital to address the traumatic effects of homelessness and can help us end generational homelessness.
Thank you. Ms. Lepa?
Yes, thank
okay,
you.
Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here this afternoon to share with you the importance of early intervention services for young children who have or are experiencing homelessness. My name is Janelle Lepa, and I am the Family Housing Programs Director at Simpson Housing Services in Minneapolis, which is a nonprofit agency providing emergency shelter and transitional housing and long-term supportive housing to homeless individuals and families. Simpson has provided emergency shelter for single adults in transitional housing services to families for 30 years. In 2012, our supportive housing program served 193 families with 407 children. 52% of those families qualified as long-term homeless, meaning they had experienced one or more years of continuous homelessness or been homeless four separate occasions in the 3 years prior to entering our program. We provide weekly in-home case management supports focused around helping families achieve greater housing stability, increase income, and education goals. Over time, we've been building our capacity to respond to the needs of the very young children in our programs. This focus, in part, came upon due to the 2007 Infant Toddler Discovery Project findings that clearly articulated a need for young children to be more visible in supportive housing programs, and also the research showing that children who have experienced homelessness are far more likely to show developmental delays. In 2011, Simpson was able to hire an early childhood consultant who helped increase our staff's capacity to provide services to very young children and their parents. Our advocates, who otherwise known as case managers, began doing developmental assessments and partnered with parents to connect the young children with appropriate referrals. Last year, we were able to hire a full-time early childhood specialist on staff who targets her services to the families who are most in need. She visits with parents of very young children, focused on building parenting skills, detecting developmental delays, and connecting families with intervention services for those delays. The services have been very well received by families. However, funding for services focused on young children in supportive housing is scarce, and Simpson is incredibly fortunate to have secured private funding for the next couple of years. Most supportive housing programs do not have the resources necessary to provide this type of service. The funding specifically targeted towards homeless children is vital. In part, as others have said, parents are so focused on meeting their basic needs that the needs of the youngest children often take a back seat, and they're, as we know, they have windows of development when missed is a huge problem. Mobility is also enormously stressful for children, and we see children and have for years entering school far, far behind their non-homeless peers. We have some key learnings from our finding. When we have internally identified a delay with a child, it often will take 2 to 3 months before that child comes up on the waiting list to receive a more formal assessment in connection to services. It can take months to get a family ready to receive such an assessment, and waiting 2 to 3 months longer is really a shame. We also know that our families have a lot of trouble accessing high-quality care due to families working non-traditional work hours. Child care being so closely coupled with MFIP creates some roadblocks. And Head Start is an effective intervention, but it doesn't continue to serve families continuously after their shelter stay. So we have several families waiting 6 months on the waiting list to get for their preschool children to get into that service. And then, of course, transportation is a major barrier for homeless families. So I ask you to please support sustainable funding for young homeless children. A very wise woman recently told me, we have to work for the babies so they can grow on to mature into responsible and successful adults.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on this bill? Okay, Representative Lane, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Marcy Jeffries, you had said that the 0 to 3 in Minnesota get less services than the surrounding states. Is this, could you explain more about that?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, actually, I was unclear, the proportion of 0 to 3-year-olds who are receiving Part C in Minnesota is lower than in the surrounding states in the national average.
Okay, and Part C is part of... thank you. Part C is part of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Is that what we normally call special ed?
Ms. Jeff.
Chair, Representative Lane, yes.
And so...
Representative Lane.
Thank you. So now we have children... We currently have children 3 through 7 that are accessing special ed services through the schools?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, yes, this is provided through the school districts, and we do serve 0 to 3-year-olds in Part C. Part B is 3 to 5-year-olds, and it's really special education for young children.
Okay.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the schools are strapped in special ed already. Is this going to be actually a good place to put this services, I agree that the need is very high and very important, and the children that are homeless definitely are not going to be developing the way they could be if they were in a more stable situation. Is this the right place to put it, though, in special ed?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, I think for two reasons. One, we have documented evidence that it does reduce the need for special education when kids get older for a portion of those children. So if these children do not get special education or other services, including early Head Start, before school, they're much more likely to end up in special education. So there will be an immediate investment within a couple of years. School districts may start seeing savings. Some children may not need Part C services if the issues can be caught before they're three. So I think there'll be immediate and certainly long-term savings with this early investment, and the research supports that.
Okay. One more thing, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
How does Minnesota stack up with, for instance, surrounding states on homelessness with children?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, on the percent of children who are homeless? Or?
Yeah, just the,
Representative
right.
Lane.
I don't know.
Ms. Jeffries.
I'm sorry, we don't know. We could find
nobody
that out.
One more comment, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Lane.
Thank you. It's just very disturbing that we have to be looking for services for children that are homeless rather than just simply making them have a stable home.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, it goes to the changes in the bill, and I guess I've got a couple of different questions. One goes to the on 1.12 where it goes from they have a identifiable physical to certain diagnosed physical. Is there a list of the certain diagnosed, and what's the shift, and how does this include more folks? Why are we changing the language, and who are we targeting, I guess, is
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, there are people here from the Department of Education who can go into more detail, but currently Minnesota does serve children who have a condition that's been diagnosed and likely to result in a developmental delay. So, for example, a child with Down syndrome might not be showing a delay at 6 months, but we're pretty certain that that condition will likely result in a developmental delay, and so we can serve them early and reduce that delay. This bill would say if you're homeless, we know that's a condition, an environmental factor, that's highly likely to result in a developmental delay. So we would serve those children even if they don't have something like Down syndrome or fetal alcohol syndrome, but because we know they've experienced homelessness and they're at high risk.
Representative Howe, did you have a follow-up?
I do, because I don't understand where that falls into the difference between an identifiable and a certain diagnosed physical condition.
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, those are in rule, those certain diagnosed conditions. If somebody from the Department of Education wants to go into more detail, but it's in rule what those certain diagnosed conditions are. And like I said, it's Down syndrome, autism.
That's what I would like to see is we have identifiable conditions. So what are the conditions that are in the certain diagnosed that aren't in the identifiable? I guess where are those different categories? What are we including that we aren't including now?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, we're including children whose environment suggests that they will develop a delay, that they're at high risk for delay. So so it's a child who's homeless. So that's different than being born with a chromosomal issue that results in Down syndrome. This is a child whose environment is likely to result in a developmental delay, or is it puts them at more risk for a developmental delay. Is that so? It's not a diagnosis. It's an environmental condition.
Any other questions?
I find it difficult to understand when we're diagnosing an individual that we diagnose them with a homelessness as a condition. I think that's, I would have worded it something different, but now I understand where you're going.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, Representative Moran renews her motion to pass House File 1141 and send it, refer it to the Committee on Education Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Passes. Of course, Representative Moran, just you're on again. Representative Moran moves House File 1142, and that would be re-referred to HHS Finance. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there's, I don't see any amendments on that one either, is there? You can just go ahead and present your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so House File 1152 modifies MFIP. It prioritizes reimbursement of TANF funds, and it creates an MFIP child well-being pilot project. And so instead of me going into detail, I'm going to refer to
Ms.
Alex Fitzsimmons from the Children's Defense Fund.
What is the Children's Defense Fund pair up, which bill they each testify on? Or Ms. Fitzsimmons, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. And I first, before we begin, want to thank you, Representative Mollery, for the opportunity to talk about MFIP today and to talk about the children who are primarily the ones who are receiving MFIP assistance. And I did bring a prop, but it might take me a minute to set it up, so I'll try to set it up very quickly. But as we do talk about MFIP, to just keep in mind that 100,000 Minnesotans receive MFIP assistance each month, and that I've tried to time this, but I have not timed it appropriately, and that 7 out of 10 recipients are children. So when we're talking about MFIP, we have our adults, we have our 30% who are adults, but we have our 70% who are children. So that's who receives MFIP assistance. And one of the reasons that we wanted to talk to you today about this bill and about MFIP is because many of the policies, when we talk about MFIP, are focusing on this group of folks, and they're focusing on them as workers and not in their role as parents. And so we really want to talk about how these children are doing, that when 70,000 children are receiving MFIP assistance each month, 35,000 are under the age of 6, and the little that we know about the children receiving MFIP is not good, because we know that they're not doing well. Just for example, and you'll hear more about this in a few minutes, but 2/3 of young children receiving MFIP tested as part of a discontinued pilot project actually screened positive for potential developmental delays. And 1/3 of MFIP children had a mental health diagnosis in a longitudinal MFIP study. This bill tries to address some of those pieces and tries to improve the well-being of children receiving MFIP, and again, trying to elevate the role of parent. And with that, I will turn things over to Marcy Jeffries to talk about some of the specifics of the bill.
Ms. Fitzsimmons, I just have a quick question. You keep coming in with all these props, and I'm wondering if these play toys are your children's or your husband's.
These were mine when I was a child, and actually I used them in the HHS committee a couple weeks ago, and Representative Liebling came up to me afterwards and informed me that they're choking hazards.
Yes.
So it's a little embarrassing. But my little boy does not play with them. So I will share that.
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Jeffries. I'm with the Children's Defense Fund, and we can go through the bill section by section. So the first part of the bill is the legislative findings, and basically states what Ms. Fitzsimmons just went over about the fact that 7 out of 10 people receiving MFIP are children. And what we know about them suggests that they, many are at risk for developmental delay. The second section requires that the Commissioner of the Management of MMD allocate funds to an account to support MFIP expenditures in the event of a forecasted surplus in an amount equal to the amount of TANF reserve funds that have been used to refinance general fund expenditures since 1997. Your handout, you have in front of you a memo, a brief from House Research describing refinancing over the years, and the last page is a spreadsheet from the Department of Human Services indicating that $363 million in federal TANF funds were used to refinance the general fund. This would pay back the general fund after the school shift is paid back. The third section allows children in MFIP child-only cases to receive up to 20 hours of child care assistance per week if they're not enrolled in other early childhood programming. That's similar to the bill you heard yesterday. It would also include children who are in a child-only case being cared for by their relatives. The fourth section adds a definition of child well-being to this section of statute, meaning a child's developmental progress relative to their age. The fifth section strikes out the language that references the MFIP family cap. The sixth section relates to reports and information about children in MFIP. There's relatively little information collected and reported about children, so it would require more information about children, including the number of children and their ages who are receiving MFIP who are affected by sanctions and other policies. And it also asked DHS, the Department of Health, and the Department of Education to report on the feasibility of trying to determine more about child well-being, how children in MFIP are doing. Section 7 requires DHS to operate a pilot project in up to 3 counties to determine ways to increase attention to the well-being of young children in MFIP, especially their readiness to succeed in school. And that pilot project goals, the main goals would be to determine effective strategies to use the MFIP program to help parents identify when they or their children may benefit from mental health or other services, to provide early childhood developmental information and resources to MFIP parents, to determine the best strategies to ensure that MFIP parents can attend to their child's development and potential need for additional services, to consider county staff training issues related to early childhood development and child well-being, to test various methods of providing information about child development, including the impact of trauma and poverty in early childhood, to county staff and community staff and MFIP parents, and to maximize the use of existing resources. Section 8 requires the Department of Management budget to report on issues in incorporating long-term costs and benefits of investments and disinvestments in early childhood. Currently, the fiscal notes, as you know, only can capture 2 to 4 years of impact and often miss some of the longer-term savings and costs of our actions. Section 9 is the section for appropriating funds for the pilot projects. Section 10 changes the name of the of MFIP to the Minnesota Families and Children Assistance Program to increase awareness of the fact that 70% of MFIP participants are children. And 11 is the repealer language related to the family cap. We do have somebody here who can testify, provide additional information.
Is there a Ms. Toppin that was going to testify? Then is there anybody else that wants to testify? Come on, Tom. Go ahead, Ms. Toppin. Just state your name and where you're from.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Toppin, and I'm the Vice President of Programs at LifeTrack Resources, which is a nonprofit just down the street on University Avenue in St. Paul. LifeTrack is unique in that we provide early childhood services and MFIP services. At LifeTrack, we have the only year-round comprehensive therapeutic preschool for children who've been abused in St. Paul. It's called Families Together, and it's been around for 20 years. We work with families who are involved in child protection who also need help in parenting. We also provide home visiting and parenting services to other at-risk families, almost all of whom are on MFIP. LifeTrack is a very large MFIP provider as well. Because of all the things that LifeTrack does, I'm in partnerships with Special Ed, ECFB, Head Start, School Readiness, the county, school districts, public health, United Way, and Employment Services. I've been working with Ramsey County and DHS for over 10 years trying to get systems to do more about the well-being of young children who are at risk. This past summer, LifeTrack assisted DHS in submitting a federal grant around integrating early childhood services with child welfare services. Part of what we learned in that process was very discouraging. In Ramsey County, Child Protection referred 134 children to the early intervention system, which is mandated by federal law. So research suggests that 30% of the 134 children should have qualified for special education. And how many did? One. One child qualified. Why? Because the families fell through the cracks. They moved. They didn't follow up with the schools. When the schools called them, they had no idea why they were calling or what it was about. This is why I believe we can benefit from a pilot project to see how we can assist these families in accessing services their children need. It is not enough to simply give a parent a phone number and hope for the best. LifeTrack was involved in a previous MFIP project, a children's mental health pilot, which was funded by the legislature. And we found that when someone helped parents get their child screened for mental health issues and get to that first appointment, that services were received. If we are going to break the intergenerational cycle of TANF and poverty, we need to do something different. We know that early childhood works, but we need to get these kids connected. This MFIP child well-being pilot will help us demonstrate how a more targeted approach can work to connect the children on MFIP to the services that they need. The need for cross-training is also evident to me, as there is no sense of urgency that most workers have that these services need to happen when a child is young to get the best return on our investment. And allowing parents to count participation in approved early childhood programs as an approved work activity under MFIP makes sense and will ensure that their participation happens. What if we caught all these kids earlier? What kind of savings would we see in special education, child protection, social services, and juvenile justice? What about the future savings in MFIP? We all need to work together to leverage our limited resources to help the children. Thank you for all you are doing to support early care and well-being for the children of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Toppin. Ms. Rowe? Go ahead, just state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, MCCL. We are a grassroots organization of more than 70,000 member families throughout Minnesota. And I am here today to express our support for a specific provision which is included both in Representative Moran's bill as well as Representative Loeffler's bill, which is the bill that will be up after this. That specific provision is repeal of the family cap. The family cap legislation was originally passed back in 2003 and started to be imposed in May of 2004. MCCL opposed the start of the cap, and 8 years now into the family cap, our opposition has only intensified. Statistics obtained from the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the Department of Health provide a great insight. More than 19,540 children in more than 16,000 cases had their grants reduced in at least 1 month due to the family cap. Birth rates in families that are under the family cap have not dropped. During the time period from 2001 to 2010, the overall number of abortions dropped by 22% throughout Minnesota, but the percentage of taxpayer-funded abortions being performed in our state during that time rose from 21% in 2001 prior to the family cap to 34% in 2010 after the family cap. The reasons why women have abortions in our state have remained constant over the years. And the annual abortion report shows that women feel they cannot have a baby due to lack of financial, educational, and emotional support. Various academic institutions, including a widely cited study from Rutgers University, have concluded that not only do family caps not lower birth rates for poor families, but family caps increase abortion rates, as evidenced by our own numbers here in Minnesota. Therefore, on behalf of our membership, we urge the Minnesota Legislature to readdress this failed policy and repeal the family cap. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. I don't see anybody else wanting to testify. Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Chair Mullery. Just a couple questions regarding the bill. And thank you, Representative Moran, for bringing this up. Under the subsection 2, where we are changing the priorities, and we insert the MFIP program under after the schools are paid back. And my question is, are we changing another statute by doing this? Because there is a statute that governs how excess funds are handled. Are we? So I'm wondering, are we changing a statute within a statute? Are we allowed to do that?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name is Marcy Jeffries with the Children's Defense Fund, and this is the section of the statute where the surplus funds are dealt with. So I think this is the right place for it. Is that, can you ask your question again? Maybe I didn't understand.
Yes, and thank you, Chairman. I guess what I mean, in this one, in this bill, I know there's a specific statute that addresses how those funds, if there's ever, but I don't want to use surplus because we're hearing surplus is a bad term from Speaker Thiessen, correct? So I want to be careful about how I do this. But are we inserting this? Is this the correct place for this, or will this have to happen in another bill addressing that specific statute?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think this is where, are you asking if it should be a separate bill? It could be a separate bill, but it deals with TANF, and so we put it in this bill.
Okay, thank you. So I just question that it being in here. I would look for it in a better place. I'm not sure this is the right place. So I have another follow-up, if I could. In here, as I look at the appropriation of the funds, how are we handling the greater Minnesota appropriations outside of the metro area? Is there provisions to make sure the allocations are distributed according to need, or is it according to percentage based on population? How is that handled?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this bill doesn't change anything related to how funding is allocated. It does have the pilot projects. One would hope that at least one county that was not a metro county would participate in the pilot projects, but that's not specified, and otherwise the bill does not affect the allocation of funds.
Representative.
And thank you, Chair. And so how will you encourage that greater Minnesota participation? I appreciate the comments that you would hope one would be invited. How can we ensure that that actually happens? Because a lot of times I don't believe they always get the information. We want to make sure that they're using these resources.
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we would encourage DHS, that language could be inserted in the bill as well, that at least one of the counties that participate is a non-metro county. I do know of one county that's interested that is a non-metro county. So it may not be necessary. I think the department usually does seek, at least in a pilot project, to work with a county that's non-metro to find out how well things work there, but we could add that language. Representative Moran considers that a friendly amendment.
And I'm wondering if Representative Moran would be open to a friendly amendment to add that language, that at least one county be non-metro?
Yes.
Representative
Chair,
Moran.
I can accept that forum amendment.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you. A quick question, but before I do, I just want to comment on Representative Kreisha's concern about the use of the word surplus. I just use the very clear term on line 2.3. Instead of surplus, I just say there'll be a positive unrestricted budgetary general fund balance. I think people automatically know what I mean. That was a joke, by the way. Anyway, never mind. It fell flat. Regarding to Representative Kreisha's point about line 2.17, I guess I am a little bit unfamiliar with the language on line 2.19 when we talk about the TANF funds, TANF eligible funds being used to refinance general fund expenditures since 1997. What does that mean exactly? I guess it means that we're using TANF funds for other purposes, and I guess we probably calculated the amount that has been happening since 1997, and we probably have a balance somewhere that somebody's calculated. Is that true, or could you just give me a little bit of specificity there?
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually the handout that we passed out that is an information brief from House Research. The history of TANF refinancing in Minnesota explains the mechanism, and I can go over that briefly. And then the last page appended to that is from the Department of Human Services, and it's a spreadsheet showing the latest calculation of total refinancing. But the gist of it is that the state has been getting a block granted amount of federal TANF funds for several years since the Welfare Reform Act of 1996. And what has happened over at different periods is the state has, there are some things that the state was paying for using general fund, like the working family credit. It could use the federal TANF funds. So what it did was it substituted the federal funds for what the state was already spending money on, and then swapped out those general funds and then used them for other purposes to balance the budget, tax cuts in some years. I mean, it went into that pool of money that was available to spend for other purposes. But that's the gist of refinancing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a follow-up to that, I think I'm on the right page, but I'm not sure which line to look at. Are we saying, and I'm just throwing this out there, tell me if I'm right or wrong, are we saying there's a $4.849 billion balance that we owe to the TANF-eligible funds?
Ms. Jeffrey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, it's the next column to the left there.
Okay.
It's $363 million.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Vera.
So based on that amount, that would be the amount we would want to pay back, somewhat similar to a school shift, before we do the other things on our list. Is that true?
Ms. Jeffries?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, that is what the legislation would accomplish.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moran. I guess I just was a little confused about the family cap situation, and I'm wondering if you repeal the family cap, does that mean more assistance for every child that you have, or are you just including more families in the coverage? I was just a little confused by the testimony.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, it is my thought that for every child there's a specific amount that would be added on to the grant amount per child.
Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the grant is adjusted for family size, so an infant might increase the grant by $50 a month to $95 a month.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, and then I just had one more question on, and Representative Moran, I guess, on the first page, section one, you do the legislative findings in statute. We don't normally do that in statute, and I guess I just have some policy concerns about us putting legislative findings that are kind of fluff and unnecessary into statute. And maybe if you could just explain why you think it's important to have that put in statute. I just think it's kind of a dangerous road to go on, because we might start doing that in other areas of law where it's just not really necessary.
Ms. Jeffries, you used to work in that department, I believe.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm actually a fiscal analyst, so did not draft language, but Representative, you're right. Usually this language does not show up in statute. It's usually pulled out, but often it travels with a bill through the session so people can see sort of the intent. And then often the reviser does not include it in the statute.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Moline.
I guess, I mean, I don't know if that's true. I haven't seen a lot of bills that do that. I mean, usually we have bill briefs that would set this sort of out, which is what the intent of the bill is or the purpose of changing the statute. Normally I don't see it actually in the bill. I mean, if then the reviser's office, of course, would have to include it if we passed it on the House floor, including this language, and it became law. In order for this not to be in there anymore, we'd have to take it out in committee or take it out on the floor before it actually became law. So I just don't know if it's the best strategy to include this in the actual bill itself. I don't know, Representative Moran, if you would be willing to do an oral amendment to take it out, or I don't, maybe at your next committee stop, that's something that you can address. I just don't know that we should go down the path in, to actually include findings like this in our statutes.
Representative Moran.
Representative Chair, Representative Moline, had not really considered that, but I think we can pull it out.
or as it traveled, pull it out before it definitely reached the House floor, if it reached the House floor. I agree.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't, Mr. Burris, I don't know if we could just remove Section 1 and then...
Exactly. You make a motion to delete Section 1.
To move everything out. Well, I would move to then delete Section 1 of House File 1142.
Is there any discussion of that motion? Looks like people agree. And I was thinking of the same thing.
Yeah.
So Representative Moline moves to delete Section 1 from the bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Do you have another question?
No.
Okay. Representative Franzen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. After all that, and to the testifier, could you please explain for some of us that haven't been here all that long just exactly what has, in the past, the legislature used TANF dollars for? Could you give us some specifics instead of just saying they used it to balance the budget?
Ms. Jeffrey.
Where did those funds go to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, if you look at the last page of that handout about TANF refinancing... And I would ask if somebody from the Department of Human Services would be interested in helping to walk through this. Otherwise, you can see their definition of what refinancing is. Examples are the working family credit. Some of the child care assistance money, my understanding.
Would you state your name and then answer the question? Thanks.
Yes, Chairman Mallory, members of the committee, my name is Jane DeLage, and I work with the Minnesota Family Investment Program for the Department of Human Services. I'd like to just give a little context that, you know, there are several purposes under the TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Act, and so the money that has been shifted has to fit within those purposes. That's where I think that what... was said is it the Child Care Development Fund appears in the Social Services Block Grant are two of the areas where there has been some money that has been shifted, where TANF has been used, as was said, to replace general fund dollars. And then those general fund dollars have been... You can't say where the general fund dollars necessarily went. They go back into the pool that is then allocated out. But the funds, the TANF funds, have to go for certain TANF-related purposes. So the Working Family Credit, the Social Services Block Grant, the Child Care Development Fund, some social services, some housing-related issue or spending. I think if you look across... So SSBG is the Social Services Block Grant. CCDF is the Child Care Development Fund. You've got your MFIP cash, the Working Family Credit, there's Social Services, Housing Development, and Housing and Economic Development. I don't know that I can give you any more detail than what is listed there.
Right. Representative Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the TANF dollars being used for... what is being seen in this graph here is totally legal, correct? There's nothing shady going on.
There's nothing shady. Excuse me, Jane DeLay. No, there is nothing that is not allowable under the TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Block Grant. It's all allowable expenditures, but it does then move dollars from direct cash assistance to families to other types of services.
Representative Franzen was used for a lot of things, even job training.
Right. I understand that, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to figure out here, is the intent of the author, are we talking about stopping the use of TANF for the other issues so that it can be just used for cash assistance? I guess I'm trying to figure out,
Ms. Jeffries,
where we're heading.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, it would put more money into the TANF fund to used for purposes that the legislature determined it wanted to use it for. So, for instance, the elimination of the family cap costs $4 million. Other things that you will hear from spending, employment, and training, there would be more money available for those services.
Representative Franson, quick follow-up.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
We're going to have to...
All right. So then, if it's $4 million to release the cap, then would that $4 million come out of what pot here? The child care development, working family credit, or are you asking for that $4 million to be taken out of the general fund to fund what's currently being funded with the TANF, which is completely legal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, what the bill would accomplish is, in the event of a positive unrestricted budgetary balance, once the school shift is fully paid back, then that money would start being deposited into the TANF fund, which the legislature then could appropriate funding for what it wanted to spend the money on.
One question.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Mullery. And and on the oral amendment, I didn't actually move that, and I was just wondering if we needed to move that.
If you're going to move it, you have to move it.
That's what I thought. So, and thank you, Representative Moran, for being open to that. So I'd like to move to amend the House file to be amended as follows. On page 1, line 4, after counties, insert, which must include at least one county that is not a metropolitan county, as defined in Minnesota Statute Section 473.121, Subdivision 4. And I think that would entail the intention of...
What line was that?
Could you repeat it again?
Yes. Thank you. Page 1, line 4.
Page 5.
I'm sorry, page 5. My mistake. Page 5, line 4, after counties, insert... which must include at least one county that is not a metropolitan county as defined in Minnesota Statute Section 473.121, Subdivision 4.
Representative Moran, do you accept that then?
I do.
Okay. Then
thank you.
All in favor, we have to still vote.
Yep.
All in favor of the Representative Kreisha's motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Okay. We have to go to the last bill because we've got to cut the last one a little short because of sessions. So Representative Moran renews her motion to pass House File 1142 and re-refer it to House 8, Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Lott.
Thank you.
Does somebody want to move the bill? Somebody want to
move the Mr. Chair, I move House File 1047 to be passed and referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Representative?
Oh. On to the Committee of Health and Human Services Policy.
Policy. Okay. Is that correct, Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1047, if we could have a motion to re-refer it to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, that would be appreciated.
Representative Loeffler, that's already been made by Representative Lane.
Fantastic. I didn't hear that as we're conferring here. And House File 1047 is a result of the work of a lot of people who have been doing serious work looking at how we can step up to the issue of maternal depression, which has, I think, grown in awareness but is certainly still under-recognized in our society and even within the professions that deal with families and their young children. And I believe that you have seen at least a summary of the 0-3 Research to Policy Project report that was done by the Children's Defense Fund on maternal depression in early childhood. And in that, they summarize a lot of important research, but I just want to highlight a couple of things. It's estimated that 22,000 young children in Minnesota live with a mother who has experienced depression in the first 3 years of life. And we know that early intervention, early identification is the key to both helping that mom and their child
get through that experience in a way that allows both to fully be actively engaged in their important responsibilities of development and nurturing. And we are, and it's something that happens to people of all socioeconomic backgrounds. It happens to people who have desperately wanted their children and then run into an issue where they were just totally surprised after the child was there with being overwhelmed with family, with feelings of that can be very disturbing. They run along a continuum, as you can imagine. And it's starting to become clear that the effects of depression are on both the mother and the child. And I think that's one of the big learnings, is that that they're a unit, they're a team, they're working together, and that you really need to pay attention to that relationship and engage whatever therapy you're doing to make sure that the needs of both are being met as you go along. And so House File 1047 is an ambitious bill that tries to address many of the recommendations that came through that comprehensive study. We know that it'll probably go through some winnowing as it gets to the Finance Committee and some prioritization. But makes sure that we are early identifying people that are professionals who interact with mothers and their children, have the skills to appropriately ask the right questions and make the right referrals, and that we surround the system with supports that will enable that to happen. And with that, I'll let Marcy Jeffries from the Children's Defense Fund go through it in more detail.
Representative Loffer, I just want to clarify. You said it goes to HHS Finance, and I'm told
policy.
You want to
policy.
Go to policy.
Policy.
Okay.
Policy. Sorry.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair.
Go ahead, Ms. Jeffries.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Jeffries. I'm with the Children's Defense Fund, and we thank Representative Loffer so much for bringing this important bill forward and for you hearing it. Going through the bill, Section 1 relates to the information that's provided to new mothers, new families when a child is born. Current state law requires that they receive information about postpartum depression and where to go for help. And it has been fairly successful. But the survey that the Department of Health does annually shows that women of color and women with less education are less likely to report that they receive that information. And these are the same women who are most likely to report experiencing depression. So this requires the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services to work together to come up with a plan to figure out how to reduce that disparity and who receives that information. Section 2 defines maternal depression as perinatal depression or perinatal mood or anxiety disorder. So we use the term depression, but there are other things that happen around the time of a child's birth that also has a similar effect on a mother's capacity to care for her child and may eventually have an impact on her child's development. And we went over some of that in the informational hearing we did a few weeks ago. We appreciate that opportunity to do that. Section 3 adds families with maternal depression or other serious mental health disorder to those families who should be targeted under family home visiting. This really clarifies and strengthens current practice. Section 4 requires more information. Section 4 requires the Department of Human Services to provide technical assistance health care providers to improve screening and referral rates and medical assistance and Minnesota care. What we hear from providers is that sometimes they're uncomfortable discussing depression with their patients and they would like some help and some scripts possibly from the Department of Human Services to help them with that. And it's important to do this in the medical assistance program. Recent research, recent data from the state's PRAMS, Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring Survey System, found that women on medical assistance were twice as likely to report experiencing depression as women on private insurance. Sections 5 and 6 extend medical assistance to 2 years after a child is born. Currently, under current law, medical assistance ends 60 days postpartum, and women must reapply. We lose a lot of women at that point. The women must be below poverty to qualify for medical assistance at that point. Also, women who are experiencing depression may have a harder time actually going through the process of making the application.
Ms. Jeffries, could you go a little faster? Because we have session today, so we can't go as long as normal.
Okay. Section seven, as children.
Speed up.
Okay, section seven lets infants be automatically enrolled on medical assistance until their second birthday. This was prior law until 2003. We lost about 4,000 children a year, infants a year, with that change in 2003. Section eight adds parenting skills to the medical assistance program, the Medicaid assistance program.
Ms. Jeffries, maybe rather than.
Even faster?
Yeah, maybe just a real summary of these things.
Okay, and then the rest of the bill is intended to do more to address maternal depression and come up with a state plan to figure out how to reduce its impact on children. And we have some great testifiers if there's time.
Ms. Fitzsimmons, can you give a real quick testimony?
I will pass on my testimony.
Okay. I see Sue Abderholden's. What? Just vote for the bill? Okay.
Written testimony.
Ms. Rao, I assume you just want to vote for the bill again. Say, and reiterate the 5 minutes you said before, okay. Karen Adamson, did you want to testify or just say vote for the bill? Or okay. Go ahead.
I'm Karen Adamson. I'm a public health nurse and the program manager for the early childhood and maternal child health programs at Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health. We work with several agencies to provide intensive home visiting. Many of our visits are provided to depressed moms. Each year, nearly 15,000 babies are born in Hennepin County. Wilder Research estimates that about 10% of these babies will be cared for by a woman who is suffering from maternal depression. In addition, Wilder calculates the related costs for non-treatment of maternal depression at nearly $23,000 a year. Through a variety of public health home visiting strategies, we are now able to help these women and their families, but the important part is finding them. Maternal depression affects the basic needs of all family members. In addition, when a mother and primary care provider is depressed, typical activities that would bring her to the attention of a professional in the community are altered. Her children are less likely to receive well child exams, she is less likely to return to her obstetrician for postpartum care, and her family is not connected to resources to support for support within the community, such as targeted home visiting. But one of the most important concerns is the impact on the brain development of a newborn baby. Without the consistent serve-and-return interaction between mother and infant, the natural learning process is altered. Babies who are not receiving nurturing responses on a continual basis from their caregivers will begin to show delays as early as 6 months of age. By 18 months, babies will have fewer words and early literacy skills will be delayed. All of this impacts kindergarten readiness and a child's ability to read at grade level in third grade. The nature of maternal depression is isolation. Identifying women who are depressed can be difficult. Universal screening provided at places in the community, such as WIC, where we most frequently meet new mothers and young families, could be very helpful in increasing the number of mothers and families we can connect to treatment and resources. Targeted home visiting and in-home parenting support have been shown to be effective with mothers who are depressed. We also know that mothers may not be diagnosed within the first 6 months after their babies are born. Much infant brain development is occurring in the first 2 years of life. Being able to support depressed mothers throughout this crucial developmental time is very important to our success in decreasing the pathologic effects of maternal depression. Thank you very much for letting me share that with you.
Anyone else wanting to testify? Okay, any questions? Representative Powell, did you have a question? Okay, go ahead.
I see we're extending it out to 2 years from 60 days. What's magical about the two-year time frame as opposed to what I was thinking more appropriate as a year?
Representative Loeffler, I guess? Or?
I think that others may be able to speak to the research more than I can, but part of it is that this is really trying to build a support system for that family. And if you identify the mother or the child late and there have been those developmental delays, you want to be able to make sure that you're intervening so that child will catch up and be able to achieve their potential.
Representative Howe, did you want to follow up? Or?
Well, I'd like to see the research, because I would believe that, especially in this bill, I understand the other two bills, but I guess in this bill, I would think that, you know, if you, I'd like to see that. I didn't see that research here. I'd like to, if you could provide that, I'd appreciate that.
Representative Luff, any other questions? Okay, then we can, Representative Lane renews her motion for the bill to House File 1047 to be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you for squeezing us in.
And meeting's adjourned.